Hello, you are listening to Dev Brood, a podcast exploring the ups and downs of an independent iOS developer and the founder of a microbrewery. Your hosts are me, Dominic Williams, creator of the app Moderation, and Glenn White, founder of Brewmonster, a microbrewery based in South Wales. We'll be exploring topics such as marketing, business strategy, and raising capital, as well as the simpler things in life, like staying motivated when everything else seems to be going wrong. Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of Dev Brood. Today we're just going to introduce ourselves and our businesses and also talk a little bit about what topics we're going to cover in future shows. Glenn, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and some information about Brewmonster?
Okay, so my background's in finance. I trained with PricewaterhouseCoopers for about 5 years, became a chartered accountant. I left there, joined the FTSE 100 insurance company. I started in finance, then went into operations, and about 2 years ago started Brewmonster Limited, which is a craft brewery based just up the road in Cwmbran. We make a selection of real ales and craft beers that we sell all around the UK. We've won a couple of awards. We've opened a micropub focused on selling cask ales just down the road again in Barry. And we've also opened a brewery tap, bar in the brewery itself, where we can showcase all of our beers. We have raised in total now around £300,000 to fund all of our growth. Most recently with a crowdfunding campaign on Crowdcube, which netted us £100,000. And our plans for this year are to potentially open a few more venues. We've grown our team a little bit and we've also grown our capacity. So we've got a lot going on.
So how big is Brewmonster in terms of employees?
We have a somewhat unique structure. Myself and my main business partner, Jason, started the business. We're the two directors. We're the two biggest shareholders. But the team consists of, in addition to myself and Jason, two brewers, a head brewer, Tom, and an assistant brewer, Matt. Both of those are full-time employees of the company. We have another partner, Neil, who works in the university, and he is our graphic designer. We have Gareth, who does a bit of sales and a bit of everything else that's needed. And then most recently, we've had two new people join us, Dan and Tara. Both are working on this sort of sales and business development front. So all eight of us are all shareholders, all with different amounts of shares. Two full-time employees in the brewers and one part-time employee in Dan. And the reason I say it's unique is because the way we've been able to develop such a strong team, you know, not many startups would have a chartered accountant, a graphic designer that works in a university, and a team of eight people, and get away with only paying 2.5 employees. It's because we've given out a lot of shares in that time, so we've got this very shared structure.
So what exactly are you going to be adding to this podcast?
Hopefully I can share some of my experiences in Brewmonster. So we started with, well, personally speaking, no knowledge of craft beer. I was a lager drinker up until we started this business. We had no funding. We don't have any money between us. So we've gone from nothing to now turning over around about £70,000 a month, quarter. And we've done that with, you know, from literally a standing start with no knowledge of the industry, no contacts, no money behind us. So hopefully I can share some of those experiences and help other people who may be, you know, whether they're in the same industry or a different industry, you know, a lot of the experiences will be shared and might be of help. Dom, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and your app Moderation?
Okay, so I'm a self-taught programmer. When I was a teenager, I dabbled in web design and a little bit of Visual Basic, but never really professionally taught. Went to university, studied business management because that seemed like the right thing to do. And then had a stopgap job in a large insurance company here in the UK. And that's where I met you. And it turned into a bit longer than a stopgap as I've been there nearly 10 years now. But I guess more recently, I've been learning iOS programming. So maybe about 5 years ago, I released an app called Rugby on TV, which allowed you to track when rugby was being shown on TV in the UK. Just a little personal hobby product, just for myself, really. did monetize it, but didn't really make a lot of money, didn't really do any marketing, and then it slowly died a death. But more recently, I've been working on an app called Moderation. So I released this in the App Store in October, I believe, last year. We've had, you know, quite a few thousand downloads so far. It's a free app. And the purpose of the app really is to help people achieve their goals of, you know, living a healthier lifestyle and, more importantly, eating healthier. But it solves the problem of complication in apps that do a similar job. So we'll use MyFitnessPal as an example. They've got a very large database of food items you can search, although you can never quite find the one you're after. You can scan barcodes, you know, you can read all of their recipes and blog posts and what I would call adverts on that main page of the app. And effectively, they put in up barriers for you to just do what you want to do, which is track what you eat. So how Moderation solves this is by completely simplifying the user experience. When I was designing the app, I was trying to think, what would a food tracking app look like if Apple made it? So the idea is you can log your lunch in less than 3 seconds. And the other side of the coin is to be able to provide insights. So rather than using your data to sell ads, we'll never show ads. Instead, we'll use your data to give you information back to you that you can then act upon to make better eating decisions. And then the final sort of main pillar of Moderation is around privacy. So, you know, we do some basic analytic tracking just to understand what features are being used, but it's all completely anonymous. And, you know, we don't want your data effectively. So it's all stored on device. There's no account creation. There's no syncing to servers. So you're in control of your data. In terms of the future, I'm hoping to grow Moderation, eventually monetize it with a subscription plan, probably by the end of the year. And that's about it, really.
So what are you going to bring to this podcast?
So I'm hoping I can bring a bit of the techie side of stuff. So how to start in this world of app design and app creation. Obviously, I've got a background in my full-time job of analytics and reporting. So I think I can bring some interesting viewpoints on what a lot of apps are quite poor at doing, which is how you can utilize, you know, the customer's data in ways that benefits them. You know, whether that be sort of actionable insights or correct visualizations. So I think I've learned a lot of lessons already with Moderation. So I've explored, you know, social media influencers, how to sort of promote a brand new app because it's very hard to get noticed in the very busy app store. And then hopefully, as I learn along the way, I can share those learnings back with the listeners.
So the next thing is, what type of topics are we going to cover during this podcast?
I think we have quite a few topics we could cover. The one thing I want to talk about is social media influencers. Obviously, it's a growing sort of marketing channel. These, you know, people on Instagram with over, you know, millions and millions of followers. It's been in the news quite a lot as well because they haven't really been saying that they are doing ads when they should be. So I've had a little bit of experience with this where I was exploring how much does it cost, what type of people do you want to work with and associate your brand with? And how does it all work? Are there agencies involved? How does that payment structure work? So I think it's a good area to discuss, really.
Another area will be about raising capital. I mean, every new business pretty much needs some kind of capital behind them. Ours is a more capital-intensive type of industry. You need equipment. You need ingredients to be able to produce your beer. There's a lot of tax to pay on beer. You need to then be able to get the beer from your premises to the customer. So, you know, like I said, we'd started with no capital and we had to raise everything from scratch with just a piece of paper. So that'd be hopefully a good area to cover.
Sounds good. I guess, you know, the biggest problem of any new business really is, how do you gain awareness? How do you make people know that you even exist, let alone purchase your products? So I guess we both have some experience with that. Me from an online and digital perspective, and you with a very, very physical product.
Yeah, absolutely. Very different, completely different side of the coin. Yours is a very intangible product in a lot of ways. It just lives in the cloud. Ours is a physical product that you consume. Very different customers.
I think the way you convey value to customers is different as well. Branding, much more important in your world, whereas message, probably more important in my world.
Yep. Yeah. And different ways of monetizing as well. So the proposition to the customer is very different. Ours is a lot of it on that point of sale. People see your product. maybe even try your product, make the decision. Yours, slightly different. Probably high conversion. A lot of people will take on the product because it's free, but it's how do they become aware of it? Your customer group, target audience, whatever you want to call it, worldwide, everybody almost. Ours is only where the product physically exists.
Target customer base worldwide, current customer base, a coffee shop.
Another area to cover is how do you balance these various side projects with full-time job, with day-to-day life.
And of course, family pressures as well.
Absolutely, yep. Family pressures. I'm always in the gym. So yeah, it's squeezing everything in without going insane, without finding yourself being divorced is definitely something key to discuss.
Effectively, it all comes down to prioritization. At least that's what I found. So it'd be really interesting to know how you prioritize your work and your life, and if I can learn anything from you.
I was hoping I could learn from you. And the final one is, when, like I mentioned, we went into this industry with very little knowledge of the industry. We were aware that it was a fast-growing industry, that it was a competitive industry, but should a lack of knowledge necessarily put you off? Didn't put us off. And looking back, we're glad it didn't put us off. So sometimes it doesn't have to be scary to go into something if you don't know everything, and you don't necessarily have to spend huge amounts of time planning and thinking about it. Sometimes, you know, you can jump in the deep end and learn as you go.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people listening maybe have an idea for a business or an app, but maybe aren't quite ready to take the plunge, and maybe we can give a bit of reassurance that even when you know nothing about the industry, you can still make it work.
Absolutely. I think one of the things you can do is you can often think of ways to mitigate your risk. So, you know, having gone into the brewing industry, we've subsequently then gone into the retail industry, opening a micropub, opening a brewery tap. And it was different things that we did when opening up those venues that would reduce our risk. So, again, we can go through some of those and things for people to think about as a way to take the plunge, take the risk, but do it in a managed, balanced way.
Okay, that just about wraps up today's show. I hope you'll tune in to our next episode. If you want to get in touch, how can people find you, Glenn?
You can follow Brewmonster on Facebook, facebook.com/brewmonster. We're also on Instagram, @brewmonsterUK, and we're on Twitter, @brewmonsterUK. Or you can come along to our website, www.brewmonster.co.uk.
For me, you can download my app Moderation on the App Store by searching for Moderation, or you can follow us on Instagram @moderationapp. I'm also on micro.blog @doms, that's DOMZ. If you want to email us about the show or ask us any questions, you can email podcast@devbrewed.com.
And don't forget to check out our website, devbrewed.com. Tell me what happened this weekend with this conference.
So the first thing they announced was Apple News Plus, which is a subscription service, $10 a month. You get, I think, 200 magazines and a couple of newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, but only limited content. I think my
was it limited content?
Yeah.
So you don't get access to the entire Wall Street Journal. And they haven't really specified exactly what you get, so it's a bit of hit and miss. So you may see an article online, think, oh, I'll read it in Apple News, and then find you can't actually read it. But I guess my biggest question or issue with this is this an outdated medium? Who's going to read this? Like, are you going to use this? I know I'm not going to use it.
I'm not going to use it, I think. It doesn't bring anything more than you can get by just doing a Google search and going to the individual sites. Subscription service seems a little bit of a... Everyone, let's have a go doing subscription service. Seems like the end thing, but if everybody has a subscription for literally everything, it's all your money gone. Sometimes it's better to have a pay-as-you-go type model.
So I think their argument would be you're going to get on a plane for 10 hours, you can download these magazines offline and read them.
But you signed up to a subscription service for the rest of your life. In that scenario, I agree. You're going on holiday, you tend to spend more money. You might buy a couple of magazines in the airport and you pay a bit of a premium for it, but you know that you're on a flight for 10 hours. But you might not be going on holiday for another 6 or 12 months.
So you think they should do this, but as a purchase model?
One of the things is, if you do search around online, you come across a lot of places that they've got articles, but they're sort of, you know, locked out. You've got to sign up or subscribe or pay, etc. If they can amalgamate all that into one service, sort of like iTunes, I guess, to some extent, where you sort of just go to one place, you can get everything there, and you just pay as you go, you make a decision as to do I want to buy this or not. There's probably value in that. I don't know if there's anything out there that does that at the moment that really pulls together all of that content into one place so you've got one source to go to.
No, I don't think that is. I think everyone's trying to either control it themselves, you know, so like The Guardian, Wall Street Journal, you can subscribe to them directly, Financial Times, another one. But I think they're quite scared, I guess, to open up to other systems, similar to the streaming, really, with, you know, everyone's trying to set up their own streaming service as opposed to being on Netflix because they lose a bit of control.
There's an element of, I guess, if you, all of the different sort of news providers are all duplicating the same basic material ultimately. There's one big news story, say Brexit, everyone will do an article on that. So do you really, is there much value in almost having access to 10 versions of that same story? Or is it better to just almost have a loyalty to one of those, whether it be Wall Street Journal or The Sun, if you're that way inclined, and then you just sort of stick to them as your main source of material?
Where do you get your news from?
BBC, actually, yeah. I mean, I that's another point, is that actually a lot of the stuff you can get for free. If you want information on most of the big things that's going on in the world, you can get it for free from the likes of the BBC.
Yeah, because I think what you're saying about, like, people favouring one publication, like, I think that's true. I get it from BBC as well. So having access to all of them, for me, and I guess for most people our generation, isn't really a need that we have.
It's sort of the fact you said that actually you only get limited content on some of them, and I presume that because it's still quite early, they haven't got every single, you know, news company in the world signed up to it. You almost, yeah, that for me is a fact. It's like sort of the Amazon Prime. One of the things that disappointed me is that you sort of, you sign to Amazon Prime with this promise of you're going to get all this video content, and then actually you find them when you go on there, a lot of the material, or like a lot of the videos you want to watch, are actually, you've got to pay for them anyway. So it's sort of, especially if you're asking a subscription service where you pay a month and you see it come out of your bank every month, and then all of a sudden you're trying to use it and you're finding you're locked out of some of the ones you want to get to.
So there was a few angles that were presented across all the things they announced. One of them is family sharing. So this is, you know, you pay your $10, but everyone in your family iCloud account can access that news. So, you know, if it's four people in a family, then it's only $2.50 each, so that's not too bad. The other angle they're pushing heavily across everything is privacy. So, you know, they say they don't track what you're reading in Apple News, there's no adverts, you know, the publishers don't necessarily know who you are. So again, and they'd probably argue it's a better experience because it's, you know, a nicer native design experience as opposed to just a website.
I'd probably buy into that. I'd probably buy into they'll do a good job of pulling it all together into a single app that, you know, you can access it all, and, you know, it's quite user-friendly. But do you pay a premium of $10 a month for that privilege? It's probably not worth it, because nowadays the other websites out there, you're going direct to the websites, or they'll have apps of their own. They're probably not that bad.
I don't see how it's going to be a growth area for them, though. Like, are 20-year-olds going to, you know, start reading newspapers and magazines when they don't even know what they are?
What I would say on it, though, is you're increasingly seeing things like messaging services overtaking voice, i.e. phone calls. So there's a, you know, sometimes you can be quicker to absorb something if you read it rather than listening or watching. I guess it depends on the circumstances.
True. Maybe WhatsApp should set up a news subscription service.
They should. They probably would work.
Although they would definitely track what you're reading.
Yeah.
So, final question then. Are you going to give it a free trial when it's available in the UK?
I might. Just out of interest to sort of see it so that we can have a better discussion next time as to whether it's worthwhile or not.
Okay, I think the second thing they introduced was Apple Arcade. They didn't announce the price for this. It's not going to be available until the fall. The general gist was you pay a monthly subscription again, so there's a recurring theme here, and you get access to, at launch, they say, in over 100 games. Some of the key problems they're trying to solve here is the App Store is, you know, the biggest games marketplace in the world, but the problems are, because of in-app purchases, you have almost like these casino-style gambling-type games where, you know, young children are effectively being encouraged to keep buying coins or whatever the currency is. So Apple have come under a lot of flack for that. And if you charge for a game, you know, even if it's $1.99, nobody downloads it. So that's the problem Apple have found themselves in. So the solution is you pay, you know, presumably $10 or $15 a month. You get access to all these games, but they have to meet certain criteria, so they can't have any ads. All the content is unlocked. There's no in-app purchases, so, you know, there's no surprises. All the levels are unlocked. The really interesting thing is they must work across iPad, the Mac, and the Apple TV. So it will help plump up, I guess, you know, gaming on Mac and gaming on Apple TV, which isn't really a thing at the moment. And then the other interesting thing is Apple are effectively funding some of these games. So they're almost moving into a role of game publisher, which isn't unique in the game industry. So you've got Microsoft, you know, they got Xbox Game Pass, and you subscribe and get access to a vault of games. And obviously all of the exclusive titles on Xbox or Sony, they effectively part fund and act as publishers. So what are your thoughts on Apple Arcade?
Sounds a bit more interesting. I mean, gaming is a much bigger area than news, so there's certainly more potential there. It's interesting you said about how they are sort of providing some funding for it. Because one of the questions I was going to have is, who's going to make these games if people are paying a fixed amount each month, and that's going to then be shared across all of those gaming creators? Is there going to be enough money to really fund it? Because if you compare it to the news, for example, then somebody can knock out a news article in half an hour on their own. Someone to create a game that someone might only spend half hour on is going to cost millions of pounds. The pricing is quite important, because if the pricing is quite high for it, then who's going to sign up for it? And if the price is too low, then it's not going to have to go around for all of the gaming companies.
So I don't think anything's been confirmed, but so we don't know how much Apple will be taking of that price, wherever it is. But it's been rumoured that people, or I guess developers, will be paid on usage. So, you know, all of the money goes into a big pot, and then if your game is a really good game and therefore people are playing on it all the time, you'd get a bigger share. So it's not linked to like downloads or it's actual usage of the game, which I think is quite an interesting way of doing
it. It's good because it rewards the ones who make the better games. Certainly the ones that are more addictive and playable.
Yeah.
Playable for longer. It's a bit more interesting a concept than the news. Is there any out there that do that at the moment? This sort of a subscription model for gaming?
Yeah, so you've got Xbox Games Pass, I think it's called, which is, you know, $9.99. You get access to a load of games. You got EA, so you pay EA Access. You pay them maybe, I don't know, £30 or £50 a year. You get access to a selection of EA games. So the newest games.
Back book, older games.
Yeah, a lot of the back book, but, you know, it doesn't take too long for new games to go on there. So maybe, you know, a year later. I bought the Star Wars, yeah. So the Star Wars Battlefront, as an example, I think ended up on the vault quite quickly, and I paid £50 for it. And I had EA access anyway, so I probably didn't need to.
Yeah.
So there's subscription stuff happening, basically, in the game world. I think the interesting question I have is this a sign of Apple trying to move into that actual game console world? Because I think in the most recent iPad Pro announcement, they compared the power to an Xbox One, effectively saying it's on par graphically. And with their chips, they, you know, I believe them. And that's a device that's not plugged in. So in theory, they could make a really powerful Apple TV type machine, you know, maybe a bit bigger, maybe with some fans plugged into a wall, that could really crank out some good graphics.
It's interesting that Google recently mentioned they were going to be doing a gaming streaming, which goes in a slightly different way.
It's almost an opposite strategy of...
Absolutely, it's getting more power into your home versus getting a better connection and using power off-site in the cloud.
I think the cynic in me would say, you know, Google wants that in the cloud so they know exactly what you're doing, what game you're playing, how often, who's playing it, when. Whereas Apple don't want to know any of that. They just, you know, rather it on device. But maybe that's the cynic in me.
I guess, yeah, we're straying into the conversation of privacy, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, per se, to be given a certain amount of information about your usage.
Well, again, the theme across all these announcements was family sharing. So you pay for this game subscription service and everyone in your family has access. And obviously, your progress will be saved on iCloud and synced across all your devices. But then also privacy. So in order to be in Apple Arcade, you can't track any user behavior other than the built-in Apple, which you have to opt into. So they were pushing the privacy angle again, even though games isn't really an area people think about that as an issue.
That sounds a little bit, though, like it's sort of, rather than Apple being, oh, we're very conscious of data and we're looking out for the customer, it's more a case of we want to retain control around all the usage and stop the developers from having that.
They give access to the developers for that usage, but it's just very limited. So I think for like moderation, only 1/4 of people have opted in to share data with me based on the Apple settings. So when you reinstall the new OS, it says, do you want to share your data or not?
It's interesting, it's sort of, because you mentioned early on that they brought this out because there's been some criticisms of the game apps on the App Store. So this is their solution. I wonder what other solutions they might have explored to deal with that. Because they could have locked down some of the in-app purchases, the amount you can spend on apps, maybe some age restrictions. They could maybe have done some of that from the App Store. They've sort of gone 10 steps ahead and come up with this really big solution to it that locks down a lot of things and, you know, completely changes the business model.
Yeah, I think there's also other problems they're trying to solve. So you could release, you know, be an independent game developer, release a brilliant game, you'll just never be found because there's so many games, unless you're a big publisher who can market it. So I guess by getting in this kind of arcade, it's a way for these independent developers to maybe even get funding from Apple, but if they've got the good game, they can, you know, enter into a curated list almost.
2 years in, when there's thousands of them in the arcade, how do you get found then? More than you would if you were just on the App Store.
Well, maybe they rotate them out, you know, who knows. But I guess it seems to be a mix. I think there was like Nintendo's on the slide maybe, but a lot of the games seem to be from these smaller ones, and it's like not one person people, but, you know, small game companies with maybe 5 people and, you know, places where Apple could help by funding.
And also, who's going to be the first ones to get into the arcade? Is it going to be all the big names? Probably would be. I feel like, you know, there could be a lot of support. I feel like there could be a way that they could support the small ones in general anyway. So there's a lot of big movement in the industry towards these sort of craft breweries, away from the big generic breweries, and from, you know, just generally, you know, mass produced stuff to more locally made things. I wonder, you know, people would probably be attracted to think, you know, play a game that's created by a company that's only got 5 employees compared to someone like EA that's got probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands. I wonder if there's a way they could almost promote that some way, and that could be done in the App Store as well as it could be in the arcade.
Yeah. I guess final question, are you going to pay for Apple Arcade?
If it's a free trial, I'll sign up and have a look.
Yeah, I think I like to think I have time to play games. So I'll probably definitely do a trial if it's a trial, and maybe even do a 1 month subscription to play some of the games. But ultimately, I don't think it's for me, but I do see this being successful. I think this is a good move for Apple. I think it's probably just a toe in the water of maybe a bigger move into, you know, gaming and taking advantage of the assets they currently have, really. Okay, let's talk about Apple Card. So they've partnered with Goldman Sachs and released a credit card. Some of the main features are you sign up directly on an iPhone, so it, you know, reduces the friction of signing up for a credit card, which maybe isn't a good thing. They introduced what they call an Apple Cash, which is a rewards scheme. So you get 3% for any purchases in with Apple. This includes App Store and subscriptions. If you use Apple Pay, you get 2% back on purchases. And if you use the physical card, you get 1% back. The main difference with this compared to other credit cards is you get the cash the next day. So it's almost instant, as opposed to having to collect points or miles or whatever else and then going through some complicated redemption process down the road. They've got a really nice integration with the wallet app and some really good and interesting visualizations in terms of showing where you purchased your products, you know, like Tesco. It looks very similar to Monzo. I actually thought when I was watching the presentation that they'd effectively stolen Monzo's design. But when I compared the two, Apple's is actually better and a little bit more polished, which is probably not surprising. They show your interest rate and how much it changes depending on how much you pay, with the idea being that you will be able to manage your finances better with this information. What do you make of the Apple Card?
One of the things you mentioned, they give you the Apple Cash the next day, which is, like you said, a little bit better probably almost out of the moment. But it would have been good if they'd gone a step further and actually give it a discount at point of sale. That would probably be quite attractive. Probably doable from a technology perspective, I'd have thought.
Yeah, so I think there's reasons why they don't want to do it that way. So in terms of the strategy of Apple Cash, you get 3% on any purchases of Apple, App Store, subscriptions, iCloud, storage, you know, or buying a new iPhone. By storing that as virtual cash effectively, which you can withdraw to a bank account if you want, but by default it's just a, you know, a digital currency on your card. When you then spend that with Apple, you know, buying an app, buying a new iPad, it saves on the transaction fees. So if you're, if you got 50 quid's worth of Apple Cash, but then your monthly iCloud comes out to 250, then they're not paying any transaction fees. It's all virtual, all stays within the Apple ecosystem.
So the Apple Cash can only be used with Apple products?
No, it can be used whenever you use your card.
So anything you can use your card for, you can use the Apple Cash for?
Yeah, but I guess what they're betting on is, because it's 3% cash back on Apple purchases, that way you get more cash and then you're almost encouraged to use that cash to then get more cash.
I just thought it would have been a really, it would have been a really innovative development if they'd said, you use this card and as you pay for it, you're getting a discount at that point, even if it's only 1% because it's on non-Apple products. It would just feel like if somebody's there with two cards in their wallet and they could pick up one and they're going to save 1% by using that to buy a TV in Kerry's, other stores available.
Yeah.
It might be quite a powerful proposition for people to then use Apple. And I guess what they want is the people to just sort of start to use Apple Pay, Apple credit card, etc. in the same way that phones have become such a, you know, extension of people's hands.
I think for me it's close enough that it essentially is that, you know, you get it the next day. Is anyone really going to quibble about waiting 24 hours? But then, you know, how many transactions are Apple processing every day and having to pay MasterCard and Visa? These probably a low fee, to be fair, because they're such a big customer. But, you know, all that money they could just claw back almost for free just by providing a credit card.
Are there any other costs involved, annual fees?
No, so they you know, had a very clear no fees, no annual fees, no late interest fees, no late, you know,
so charges. You can sign up for a titanium card, get it to the post, take it to your local scrap dealer.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much you get for it.
Titanium is quite expensive. I was surprised they said titanium.
Yeah.
Is it one card that lasts forever? You don't get one, a new one every 3 or 5 years?
I think there's no fee for replacement cards, I think, from what I saw somewhere. So if you lose it, you can get a new card and not have to pay. So this is some of the interesting security features. So the card itself is very minimalistic in typical Apple fashion. It's got an Apple logo, a chip and your name, I believe, etched in it, and that's it. There is a security magnetic strip on the back, so it's still using some of that archaic kind of technology. But the way it's protecting your security more than the traditional credit card, the card number on the magnetic strip, you don't know what that number is. So you're reducing the risk of it being, you know, stolen if you've entered it online. But then the next question is, how do you buy a product online or maybe, you know, over the phone when you need to give a card number out? So you go into the app and it'll generate a unique one-time use credit card number. So you can give your credit card number to, you know, BT over the phone maybe. And once that's used, that number's then discarded. And the same applies to the CBC security code. So those are generated new for each transaction. And then obviously if you use an Apple Pay, then you skip all of that kind of technology and instead they generate the kind of secure tokens that they've been using, which is, again, the retailer never sees your card number, doesn't know anything about you, can't track your purchases, all of that type of benefits and security and privacy.
It sounds good from a security perspective, the one-time numbers, etc. But often if you're on the phone and you need to give a credit card number, or you're on the internet, quite often you'll be on your phone.
True.
So, and if you're going to use your phone for that anyway, why do you even need the physical card in the first place?
I think the physical card is just for those places where, you know, you have to pay by card. It doesn't accept Apple Pay yet, or contactless, you know.
But couldn't the card could be built into the phone using the NFC technology?
I guess it's for the, you know, the countries. Well, the countries where, so even in America, I think they still have quite a low contactless or NFC technology. So you have to put your card into a machine or swipe it, depending on, you know. So when I was in New York, it was like swiping the card is how you pay, which is peculiar to us Brits, I guess. But, you know, they still rely on magnetic strips.
It feels like Apple normally try to be, when they come in to an industry, to be quite disruptive, to come up with something that's better than the competition. But it doesn't feel like they've quite got it with all the aspects yet. Outside of the security, does seem quite good. But then, touch wood, I've never actually had an issue with fraud on my name or my account. So I'm not necessarily going to change all my habits on the basis of a technology that they claim is so much more secure when actually I haven't really experienced an issue with it myself.
I think you look at the world and you've got all these data breaches, you know, credit cards and usernames, passwords leaking. For me, you know, the two... So this is a product which, if or when it becomes available in the UK, I will definitely get. The 3% on Apple purchases is a no-brainer for me. I spend a lot of money on Apple. You know, having just 1% on any other purchases will be useful. It's free cash at the end of the day. But then I do value that security and the privacy element, and it's a cool as fuck card.
Yeah. I'll probably sign up for one just to see the card, if it's not going to cost me anything.
Get your name laser etched.
I like that. It sounds like it'll be quite cool.
Do you think it's an area they should be entering in?
I think I'd agree that the credit card, debit card, payment industry is a little bit lacking innovation. What's the biggest innovation what's the biggest, most recent innovation? The contactless, that's quite a few years old, limited the transactions up to £30 in value. Really good, really well adopted, but that hasn't really been built on. What was it prior to that? Probably chip and pin. And that's going back a long time. So it definitely feels like this could be shaken up. Two big providers of Visa and MasterCard offer completely the same thing. There's a lot of providers that do credit cards that utilise the Visa and MasterCard technology. A lot of them just give cash back and things. But again, it's not the most... Often it's limited on its first so many transactions. So really what it's rewarding is people to just shop around and jump across different cards because they just give you these attractive introductory offers. That's why I thought if they could do something like give you the discount actually up front, it would be a real, you know, big innovation, would really, you know, improve the proposition.
It could be a stepping stone, I guess, because they partner with a bank to do this and with MasterCard as well, I think it is. But in theory, they've got the, you know, the cash to bankroll a service like this if they ever needed, and then they'd control it end to end. So I guess they're probably at the, you know, the whims of Goldman Sachs and MasterCard in terms of, you know, what they can and can't do to a certain extent.
So I don't know. I think, you know, I guess it'd be interesting to see, you know, if this, you know, helps them get further embedded into the industry. Perhaps later they can bring some more innovations and utilize some of their strengths a bit better. The fact they've gone, it's a credit card. Seems like it's probably a little bit easier and a little bit less of a foot into the industry than. So they're still behind the likes of Monzo, who are an actual bank and effectively offer a current account. So you can actually pay your wages into that. You can live with Monzo and not have a bank anymore. Can't do that with Apple yet. So it'd be interesting to see where they go from here.
So the final big service that they announced at this press release was Apple TV Plus. So I thought this was a really interesting segment. It felt very un-Apple-like. So they were basically rolling out celebrity after celebrity after celebrity.
I would note that the celebrities they brought out were sort of, for me, not the young, exciting, up and come in. It was like the has-beens to some extent.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, how old is she now? She was like 50? Spielberg about 80? I mean, done some awesome films, but his best films were decades ago.
J.J. Abrams, he's...
Was he on stage?
Yeah, although he's getting on a bit, I guess.
Fair enough, he's done some of the best films of recent years.
So, it was a bit weird, and they kept saying Apple TV Plus, the destination for the world's greatest storytellers. So it was almost like an advert to other creative writers and producers to come and work with Apple. As opposed to, it didn't feel like it was aimed at customers. There was no mention of price, there was no trailers. Each celebrity, I guess, explained what their show was about, which was interesting to hear from a creator's perspective why they were passionate about this TV show. But it just all felt a little bit weird.
So are they trying to come up with something that's going to be a better way of getting content from the producers and the actors, i.e. the content to the customer? Or are they going to try and say they're going to come up with better content than what's currently being produced?
I think they're pitching better content and that all of the great content should be produced by Apple.
They're saying that they can do better content than is already being produced by these big multi-billion pound TV studios that have been going for decades, if not longer.
That seemed to be the pitch, yeah.
Seems a little bit odd for a technology company to think they can do that, despite their deep pockets.
I guess they probably see themselves as more of a creative, save-the-world type company as opposed to a technology company. But I guess this will be the greatest test of that, if that is true.
For me, I don't see how they're going to really improve the process of getting the content to the consumer, because there's already good things that exist for that, and very competitively priced. Netflix, Amazon Prime being the obvious ones. There's some really good companies out there that produce good content, and have for years. Disney is obviously one that always pops into the conversation. For me, for the only way they can compete and really take a bit of market share, other than they'll take a little bit anyway just because of their entrenched position and they got, you know, millions of users using their products, etc., etc., would be to produce better content.
So is it worth talking about some of the content that you've brought up a few times? So one of the shows, I can't remember the name, but I quite like the sound of this one, is about sort of set in the 50s and 60s, the space race, but an alternative timeline where Russia land on the moon first. So it's a bit of a sci-fi, a bit of, you know, alternative reality. So I quite like the sound of that TV. So the other one was the Aquaman guy, whose name I always forget, a TV show called Sea. And the premise of this is there's some sort of outbreak or plague in the future where all of humanity lose the ability of sight. And then, so the entire cast are sort of, you know, acting blind effectively. And it's been so long since that happened that people think that sight was a myth and maybe didn't ever exist. So sort of telling that story. And apparently it's going to be the most expensive TV show produced, you know, more expensive per episode than Game of Thrones. So a lot of money, a lot of high production value being thrown at that one.
One thing I would add is when we talked about them going into this industry, it feels like the right thing for them to do would have been to like buy out a company. Because they're so far behind the curve getting into it. And the rumours I get floated around would be, do they buy a Netflix, do they buy a Disney? And for me, the no-brainer would be they'd buy like a Disney, get access to all of that content straight away then. So we know that they can compete with Netflix as providing a platform, you know, a medium through which you can watch content. But what I have no confidence in is their ability to do enough really good content to out-compete all these others who have already been invested in original content for a while. But to buy out something like a Disney, they've got their big, massive backbook, like a lot of the franchises like your Star Wars and your Marvels, which would, you know, put them straight up there as they can do a really good technology side of things, and they've got a lot of content, all of a sudden they become a major player.
I think they've missed the opportunity to buy Netflix or Disney. I think, you know, that was maybe three years ago was the optimum time to do that. I see it as being too much of a risk in terms of money. You know, they've pumped $1 billion apparently into this. That's a fairly small risk from Apple's, you know, pockets. But buying Disney, albeit no doubt would be successful, but it's a lot of money in an area that they don't really know what they're doing.
But you'd want it to be, they'd have to be exclusive, where the only way to get Disney is through them. And then, not unless they buy Disney. No. If they could get that, then game changer. The key is, though, that you could do it as a share-for-share purchase, almost like a merger to some extent. And I guess the key to making like a merger work is the synergies. So do you add value to the Disney part of the business by it being part of Apple? And do you add value to Apple by bringing in Disney? More than just... So if Apple's worth $700 billion, Disney's worth $100 billion, is the combination worth more than the sum of the parts, i.e. is it worth more than $800 billion? I feel like it would be. Because Disney are seeking a way to distribute their content better. Apple want to get into this industry, but just don't have the content, and then have to invest more than $100 billion to really get anywhere near the, you know, the level of content of a Disney. Bring them together, so have a lot of synergies. So, for me, that would have been the right way to go, even at this late stage.
I guess we'll watch this space.